Look at what I found. Sunshine's new play toy.
You had no business going through my things.
Looking for a light.
That's bullshit. You were snooping. Now give it back. Careful!
Why? Is it loaded?
No. It's only meant to scare people.
For someone who's never seen a Western on principle, you have an awfully keen interest in firearms.
From Slightly Unbalanced, we are still Queer as Folk. I'm Patrick Randall.
And I'm Matt Dominguez.
Today we're talking about episode 5 of season 4, and it's called How Far You Can Go.
It first aired on May 16, 2004, and was written by Sean Postoff, his third of 7 episodes. He was also the story editor of 14 episodes and executive story editor for 12 episodes. That leaves his fingerprints on almost half the series.
How Far You Can Go was directed by Kelly Macon, his fifth of 11 episodes.
This episode title reminds me of How Far I'll Go from the Moana movie. Sorry. Here's what happened in How Far You Can Go. Cody's crusade against straight people takes a sinister turn when he teaches Justin how to fire a gun and then digs up an unsavory character from Justin's past. Daphne takes matters into her own hands, go Daphne, and makes a feeble attempt to cajole Brian into intervening in Justin's increasingly angry and erratic behavior.
I wrote this one myself, too.
Very clear.
Facing an unfriendly judge in the custody case of her lesbian friends, Melanie is removed from the legal team, and with Brian's help, faces the uncomfortable reality that she will have to take the high road and sit second chair on the case. Ted gets Brian's business up and running, which begs the question of how they were doing business for the last two episodes.
They were business.
Law. All the while, Ted is working through step 8 of his 12-step program and making amends to a mostly welcoming group of friends that he fucked over while on the crystal pipe.
Emmett.
I told you I wrote it.
Emmett, Vic, and Debbie are all getting accustomed to their new living arrangements. Emmett realizes that he's lonely by himself after a trick blows his load all over the sofa. I saw it looks like he was using a little bit of shout to get that out. Vic suddenly has 6 new friends over for dinner when Debbie makes an unannounced appearance and overreacts to not being their first guest. And another pointless Ben maintenance story. Michael hates Ben's new book. I forgot he was even writing one.
I don't think he had written a book since that first one that he gave to Michael in maybe season 2, episode 3.
Like when they first met.
Right. And he wrote that corny inscription in it. So Justin and Cody get dangerous, our A story of the night. Thankfully, this is the last episode for Cody Bell.
Thank God.
Mitch Morris played the character wonderfully. I really like him, but as we've talked about in the previous episodes, this story was really strange.
As this whole thing progresses, it continues to boggle my mind that Justin was having trouble acknowledging that this guy is clearly dangerous.
Drink the Kool-Aid, Justin.
Have you noticed that the entire Pink Posse has left?
Yeah, and they stopped wearing pink. That should say something, right?
Yes, it was all baggy cargo pants. And just baggy everything. What was going on during this time? Because that was insane.
I think this whole story is just so out of whack with Justin's growth as a human being. Because if anything, the story needed to be in season 2 after he got bashed. That would have made some sense. If he was all worked up over getting bashed, had all this anger towards straight people, Chris Hobbs, etc., the story works.
Yeah. And then I think
season 4. Ooh.
But now I think if this had happened in season 2, maybe instead of the Pink Posse, he would have joined the Pink Panther Brigade. Do you remember this in that movie, Jeffrey, the Pink Panther Brigade?
Oh, yeah, Patrick Stewart.
We're the Pink Panthers. We're part of a patrol to prevent gay bashing. It was Darius's idea to join up.
I wanted to do something.
Something with a t-shirt. Pink Panthers. Oh, hello, darling.
Is someone in trouble?
Really? No. Oh, no.
What?
We must get over to Washington Square right away. It's Todd, that huge bodybuilder from the gym.
Oh, no, not Todd.
in shorts.
Huh?
So much time has passed since Justin got bashed in season two. I'm glad that this outlier is just over. It almost seemed like a throwaway story from season two that they liked and thought, okay, let's work this in at some point. Hey, it's season four. Let's work it in.
Yeah, I think if it just hadn't been so clumsily put into the situation, it would have been interesting to revisit, because I think the episode is trying to touch on something that's interesting and that maybe Justin hasn't fully resolved the issue. That I'm here for. But do they really need to have Cody Bell and this faux pink posse situation to do it?
I think it's rather ironic that some of the more interesting stories that really have some legs to them just get wrapped up in 42 minutes, where the worst stories carry on for four episodes with a guest star.
Save for Ethan. Ethan was great to have as long as we
did. He had 10 episodes.
Yes.
Isn't that dreamy?
But again, they got rid of him in a very tidy way. In a way that didn't really match what his character was. So the fact that we get Cody Bell for only the four episodes of this season, why bother?
I feel like somebody out in the fanfic community really needs to plug some of these holes here and really connect everything together. Yeah, want that too. Cody is teaching Justin how to handle a gun, which left me thinking that this dynamic duo is escalating their war. I mean, they're at a gun range.
Tell you my little secret. See how it has no face? Well, I give it one. Someone who deserves a bullet between the eyes.
Like who?
Like Wayne, captain of the football team. He and his jock buddies held me down while he carved faggot on my ass with a penknife. Bang! Or Mr. Mackley, who made me show it to the class. Bang! Or my father, who slapped me across the face when I told him what they did. Bang!
Yes, and I thought it's so obnoxious that it feels very lazily researched in how the violent behavior grows with Cody. Like, it just from the moment we meet him, we know that he is, let's say, lack of a better term, a radical.
Bad news.
And Justin just goes along with it. And then even when the rest of the Pink Posse is like, I signed up to protect people, not incite shit, I'm out. Justin's saying like, no, that's what we have to do. And like, you are pouring the Kool-Aid for everybody and it's not working, Justin. Please be a little bit smarter.
I like that tough dyke that was in the posse.
Yeah.
She's like, this is fucked.
It's like, thank you. Someone said it.
Right. I didn't really like Brian's gunplay with Justin.
Look at what I found. Sunshine's new play toy.
You had no business going through my things.
Looking for a light.
That's bullshit. You were snooping. I give it back. Careful.
Why? Is it loaded?
No. It's only meant to scare people.
For someone who's never seen a Western on principle, you have an awfully keen interest in firearms.
Where'd you get it?
Cody gave it to me.
How thoughtful.
The first rule of firearms is that you always treat the gun as loaded. He's pointing the damn thing right at Justin and pulling the trigger.
Well, at one point, he points the gun at himself.
Yeah, the second rule is don't point it at your boyfriend. Third rule, don't point it at yourself. I'd put the boyfriend first, right? Don't kill the boyfriend.
But like in Brian's case, you would put Justin first.
Good point.
Sure, okay. but yeah, exactly. You're handling a weapon that I guess we're assuming is unloaded, and yet you're still going to act like... I would have expected there to be a reaction on Justin's part to say like, whoa, wait, or like...
Yeah, he kind of did, but it wasn't like... make a diving tackle for the gun and wrestle it out of Brian's hand. It was just like, don't fuck around. It's like, but okay.
Or well, what else are you going to do? Like, I almost expected there to be one bullet in there.
Oh, yeah. So like that, a ricochet like, off the ceiling.
Well, to get like the point across that this thing was actually dangerous or something.
What I find interesting is that Justin hadn't yet told Cody the full story of his own bashing. Supposedly, this is why Justin is all riled up. But he didn't fill in Cody at episode four.
No, they wanted to give each other handies first before getting to the
We had to bring Daphne out of storage to blab about it.
See that bullet hole right between the eyes? He was thinking of someone before he fired it, but he wouldn't tell me who.
Bet it was Chris Hopps.
Daphne.
Thought so.
Who's he?
He's this high school jock I jerked off once. After that, he didn't like me very much.
I always suspected he was secretly in love with you.
Which sounds like some of the assholes I went to school with. They were probably afraid of being queer.
Yeah, whatever he was.
When he saw me at the prom, dancing with Brian.
Which, for the record, was unfucking real.
He freaked. Afterwards, he followed me to the parking garage with a baseball bat. He smashed my skull.
That's enough for Cody to track down Chris Hobbs, who appears to be a construction manager of some sort now.
Yes, he's a supervisor.
But at the trial, it was mentioned that he was going to go to college. So I'm curious how he ended up on this job site so quickly. Did he drop out of college? Did his career fall apart? Did he join daddy's firm? It's like, how did this character come in?
How was he? Because he's saying like, what, you want a job? And things like, wait a minute. When did you become the person in charge of this construction
You're 19.
Site? What?
Well, at any rate, he sure does look big and scary and hot now.
Yeah, just enough of that almost dad bod straight guy that I'm very into.
I kind of wish that Daphne and Cody would have fought a little more than they did.
Oh my God, because Daphne could easily hold her own against Cody.
I also thought that Brian's temporary moral dilemma over Justin was pretty light treatment. He's unhappy about it. So he goes to Babylon to drink alone and needs Ben to tell him that an eye for an eye isn't the way to go.
An eye for an eye, or turn the other cheek. Fight fire with fire, or do unto others as you would have them do. You know the rest. So, which is it?
Depends on the circumstances.
You're saying there's no such thing as absolute right or wrong, that morality is merely a matter of circumstance?
What the fuck are we talking about?
Say somebody bashes you, nearly kills you, does that give you the right to go out and do the same?
Of course not.
Why?
Because two wrongs don't make a right.
Besides, there are laws.
But what if the law failed to protect you? What if the law doesn't give a shit? Then what?
Then I guess you'd have to take the law into your own hands.
No. Violence is never a moral option.
But doing nothing and letting someone bash your brains in, it is.
Why didn't Ben channel his Buddhist monk sensibilities there? And why was Brian drinking alone over this anyway? I didn't feel like Brian was totally wrecked over this. Well,
and they pull out this lame Shakespeare reference in the moment. Because Ben is literary right now.
He is book.
Right. I'm like, what is the point of this? And of course they have to pull out one of the oldest Shakespeare quotes that you could possibly think of, which is something from Hamlet. It's from "to be or not to be" speech. And I'm like, okay, great. Thank you. You pulled the most famous Shakespearean speech you could possibly find.
You are an professor.
Like it was, I eye rolled so much, and I'm eye rolling now just thinking about it.
Well, when Daphne shows up at Brian's office and is briefing him, Brian seemed kind of conflicted about it, but it all just rang really hollow for me because he never really did anything about it.
And yeah, they,
I don't know.
They wrestled in the last episode.
That's true. That was hot.
Right. And here he found the gun and that was it.
And he went and had drinks by himself because he was all upset.
Yeah.
Wah.
Like really, Brian? Like this is the Brian we want to have right now?
This whole wrapping up of the Cody story really got me wondering about his motivation.
He had one?
Oh, well, I don't think so, but what is it that he gets out of pushing Justin to go face-to-face with Chris Hobbs, his attacker? The only thing I could think of is to cement his cult-like hold on Justin, but he went to a lot of trouble to track this guy down, and surely it wasn't just to help Justin move past his previous bashing. It just makes me think that Cody was trying to start a cult and go on a murderous rampage with Justin.
That's exactly what this show is trying to portray Cody Bell.
He said that he had a cachet of weapons hidden away. This is like the...
Like that is Jonestown. That is Waco, Texas. That is like some scary shit.
Right. But then it's over.
Like you're not going to do anything with that? Like that is... Yeah, because we...
Call Carl Horvath and have Cody picked up.
Because we hear Cody mention that as they're going to the construction site the first time that people collect all sorts of things. I collect weapons.
Right.
Shouldn't we shouldn't we be concerned about this situation?
Yeah, but it just ends. That's it. So Justin's final confrontation with Chris Hobbs was probably the most ridiculous and absurd moment in this show.
Oh my So, yeah, let's walk through this.
So think about it. Justin, the artsy twink and comic book writer who spent an entire season besotted with a nice older man, is now a loaded gun-wielding maniac who makes his victim suck on the barrel of the gun.
Like, that is... I didn't expect him to make him suck on the barrel of the gun. I was like, I thought he was going to make him suck Cody's dick for a second.
Oh, that would have been better.
Right?
Oh, but then that's good.
You're welcome.
Well, okay, again, season two, maybe. But even then, this is really far-fetched. This is something that Ted might have done while he was tweaked out on Crystal, but Justin?
It doesn't make any sense. Especially because then that's how far he goes in terms of scaring Hobbs. That's it.
Yeah, done.
By the way, all in Hobbs's backyard.
Well, yeah, this was some really amateur writing and something more likely to be on a soap opera. One more thing about Chris Hobbs in his backyard. There is zero chance that Chris Hobbs wouldn't call the police on Justin and Cody after they just threatened to kill him.
Yeah, it's like you're going to tell me that just by saying like, oh, you don't want to tell the cops that we came because you don't want to hear them say, tell them that two faggots made you do this. Like,
yeah.
No, I think he would still be like, I got assaulted by these two guys.
Yeah, they have a gun. Because Chris Hobbs has always been about revenge. He would have no trouble putting Justin and Cody in jail to protect himself and be the big man. So it just ends. We never see Chris Hobbs again. This was his last episode. This was Cody Bell's last episode.
What a waste.
But more importantly, what does this say about Justin? After this episode, it never comes up again. Chris Hobbs is just gone from the show, never mentioned again. Justin's psychopathic and murderous moment is just all but forgotten. He should be locked up.
This is what heals him?
He was going to murder that guy.
But apparently not.
Yeah, where's Carl Horvath when we need him?
And then the fact that Cody's rants fade into the credits...
Right.
I'm like, we're just going to acknowledge that none of this happened again.
Something came to mind is that Michael, Ted, and Brian spent the night in jail because Michael mouthed off to a cop when they got pulled over in the Pennsylvania Turnpike on the way to New York. Justin threatens to kill a guy, stuffs a loaded gun in his mouth, and that's it.
But just point of a clarification, it wasn't a loaded gun, though.
Are you sure?
Well, because there was that moment when Cody kicks out the barrel and spins it, I thought that was meant to show that it was empty, but go ahead and scare him.
Oh, I thought it meant, the gun's loaded. Have at it.
Oh, well, then I guess that would make sense.
Now's your chance.
I guess it would then make sense why Cody was saying, like, why didn't you do it? Okay.
And that's a really interesting.
Now I kind of want to go back and like make
maybe
sure
this writing was good.
I don't go that far.
Something occurred to me with what Justin says about his bashing. With all the harm that Hobbs had caused Justin, it seems like Justin and his family would have cause of action against him when Justin's saying, you get left me unable to draw, permanent brain damage, etc. If Chris Hobbs was responsible for permanent brain damage, that's a lawsuit right there.
Yeah,
where is Melanie?
Where's the civil lawsuit? I understand the criminal lawsuit. Where's the civil one?
Yeah.
Come on, Melanie. You are law.
Well, she'd probably lose the case. She never wins a case.
She gets lucky when she wins a case. She gets lucky with her clients, apparently.
Still Queer as Folk. There's more on the way. Melanie is law. So we see Melanie wearing her baby bump.
Yeah,
this episode.
My first thought was Gus is growing and so is Mel's stomach.
It seems like her bump comes and goes from episode to episode. Sometimes it's there, sometimes it's not.
Sometimes like someone decided, you know what, I'm going to pump a little air into this thing today.
Something I noticed is whenever Melanie's lesbian couple, her clients are in the room, they're always holding hands and they always look like they are at somebody's deathbed.
They are in constant mourning.
Yeah. The story around them is important, but the characters themselves basically have no role in this story other than to be the furniture and sit there and look sad. They have like a total of 5 lines.
They said their names numerous times in this episode. I cannot remember their names.
Anna and Jeanette Arlen. I knew you'd say that, so I wrote it down.
Thank you. Because, again, I know, like, I heard the names. I heard them. As soon as the episode was over, I was like, who are they?
This story is all about Melanie, so it kind of didn't matter, but I just thought it was silly for a show that is ostensibly pro-gay to marginalize this story so much and just make it so much about Melanie. Considering how many goofy stories we get, it would have been nice to have Anna and Jeanette's story really be told out, but we never see it play out, though. We just know that their kid is with the father.
Yep.
That's all.
And I agree about it, the way Melanie does make it about her.
Yeah.
And it just, it bugged the hell out of me. She's like, no, but they fired me, who's also a lesbian with a child. And they're like, yeah, but do you understand that the way things are now? And I think this is supposed to be the greater point about it, is this just proves the point of how marginalized we are. But why the fuck are you making it about you? Their child is on the line. It is not about you. It is about saving their child, Melanie. Jesus Christ, get a grip.
The note that I wrote down was, what a terrible lawyer. She lost focus on her clients and made the whole thing about herself. Shocking.
She might have lost the case.
I've fired lawyers before, and without fail, they've always been like 100% professional about it. It's just part of their DNA where they have my best interest at heart, whether I want to have them working for me or not. And if I choose to have another lawyer, then they're fine with it.
Then so be it.
Yeah, but not Melanie. She goes and locks herself in the bedroom.
Yes, and like it's like snacking and shit. That was
weird humor. It's because I remember back when Brian and Melanie outright hated each other. In this case, Lindsay calls up Brian and says, come save Melanie.
I've tried talking to her, but she wouldn't listen. Now she refuses to leave the bedroom.
Well, eventually they come out to feed, but if I were you, I'd lock up the livestock.
Brian!
Why the fuck did you call me? I have no practical skills whatsoever in talking lesbians out of trees.
But you do have a remarkable ability to put things in perspective, see them in a purely objective, practical way.
So like, I don't know why that was her first call.
Because he is, I guess, a straight shooter.
Which is true, but straight shooter to Lindsay.
Yeah, not to Mel.
Right. Melanie gets all worked up and accuses Lindsay of betraying her. And
yes, woe is me, woe is me.
Which I understand the story, but it was very rudimentary. It didn't challenge me at all when I was watching it. I was just waiting for the next shooter drop because it was so predictable. It was Melanie having problems at work, Melanie losing the case, Melanie being set straight by somebody. Next.
Yes, and eventually she gives in and acknowledges, thanks to, I guess, a long walk with Ted.
I like that scene, though.
Because it shows them being somewhat rational creatures between two people who have been through it.
The first runner in this episode, I labeled, Home is Where the Ass Is. That's the title of season 2, episode 1. I was disappointed that Emmett's story was so brief in this episode because I thought that was really good. He has a cute apartment.
Which, okay, and let's talk about this apartment because first of all, he gets a loft.
Yep.
That has the raised platform bed. At first I thought somehow Brian had rented his loft to Emmett. So I was happy that they had this meta moment and Brian's like, yeah, this loft looks awfully familiar.
Was there any significance to that though? I mean, what for?
Like Jennifer says, let's face it, it's a fuck pad.
Okay. I can get there with that. Cause that seems like what Emmett would be looking for. It would have been better if Jennifer found it for him and was showing him.
Yeah. The room. Why isn't she being the, you know, real estate with all of them?
Realtor to every major character.
Mm-hmm.
Something I thought was funny in that first scene when we see Emmett's apartment is Brian's eating a sandwich.
Yes.
Which seemed a little weird for Brian to be the only one eating in that scene, let alone being so sloppy about it. He's not a sloppy eater.
I feel like he did that just to annoy Emmett.
Yeah, it just seemed like kind of a gimmicky prop to have there. It's like interior, Emmett's new loft, resembles Brian's. Brian, a sandwich, drip. So... I don't know. It just seems a little goofy. I did like how Emmett's trick shot a load a good 10 feet across the room onto the Tijuana chair, as Brian called it.
Did you know who that trick was?
No. Who was that?
That trick is PJ Dubois from the film Short Bus that John Cameron Mitchell made. Kidding. In 2006.
We talked about that last episode or the episode before.
And then enter Emmett's trick. And I found that really fun. I like recognized him right away. And and listeners, if you want to see what he has to offer in full view, rent the movie Short Bus.
I think we could tweet that too.
We should.
Yeah. It's funny how we look at these random hookup scenes with Emmett now in 2019 and just assume that Grindr or Scruff was used to summon the trick over. But yeah, this was 2004.
So they were using what?
I don't know.
Well, we've seen websites in earlier episodes.
Jerk at Work. Use My Hole 27 was in there. I think back to 2004 and when I was looking for a trick and I wanted to bring a gentleman home or spend a erstwhile few minutes with a gentleman at his home in his drawing room, you'd go out to the bar.
I was a sophomore in high school.
You'd buy somebody a drink and that's kind of what it is. And then I think shortly after that, Manhunt came out.
I was a sophomore in high school, so.
Okay. One I do know that you know is Dude's Nude. Not Dude's Nude.
Yeah, that's what it is.
But there is another one that we looked at. Adam for Adam.
Oh, wow. Yeah.
Yeah. Remember the, like in season one, I had mentioned it and you pulled up your computer to see if you had the password saved. You didn't.
No.
I'll have to go back and find that cut. Okay. I felt a little bad for Debbie.
Oh, I did too. I really did too. I understand that she has empty nest syndrome. It was just heartbreaking, especially when she goes over to give Vic and Rania a housewarming gift to see that they have guests.
But I don't attend parties I'm not invited to.
Doesn't matter.
Well, actually it does. Because you told me you weren't ready to have people over here. And when you did, I'd be the first.
This dinner is just an impromptu affair.
I'm sure. Everybody just happens to have a lobster souffle in the pantry for when five or make that six unexpected guests drop in. I'll leave you to your friends.
They apparently, as soon as they moved out, they found a gaggle of gays to be friends with. And also, can we talk about how nice their apartment was? Rodney had roommates. I'm assuming Vic was living on like disability, but now they have like full dining room.
Well, remember we realized last episode that Vic is in fact caterer to the stars. Oh,
that's true.
Yeah, yes. So he does have
some
scratch.
So he's taking a cut of Emmett's.
Right. Yeah. They're partners. Speaking of that poll that you put out about Justin saying to Brian, I thought we were partners. And Brian says, we are. Overwhelmingly, people thought that was the romantic view.
I'm still thinking it's business.
I'm going to go with romantic though.
Okay. You can,
yeah.
But there's just something about it that like, yes, they're part, but it felt so much like a business transaction to me, but yeah, our listeners have spoken.
We're used to seeing Debbie being the wise one with all the answers, but here she's just kind of falling apart and acting unexpectedly, which is kind of nice when you see a character be that rock for so long in a series. Eventually the writers start tinkering with that and try to throw in some obstructions. I don't know. I just didn't like seeing Debbie irrational.
Unlike the last episode where she had her freak out with Michael.
Oh, right.
She doesn't have this with Vic and Rodney. I saw genuine hurt and all she could do or muster is say, here's the housewarming gift. I know it's a party that I'm not invited to. And it was like, to have such a soft-spoken moment with that was really emotionally earned.
But I thought that her moment of saying to Vic, I don't go to parties and I'm not invited to. Well, so what? You know, you showed up, you were there, and Vic said, sis, stay, meet some people, come on in. Why not? I don't know that I would have that much pent-up emotion over
but she,
it.
No, but she was clearly lied to by her own brother, who she has obsessively saved from death.
Well, maybe
so
that
there has to be some hurt, especially because of how strong their bond is.
But maybe that lie was a little too weak because shit happens. You move into your new apartment, then all of a sudden one person calls and it's like, hey, are you in the new place? Yeah, I'm there. I'm going to stop by. Yeah, sure. No problem. Maybe it was like a little impromptu, but she says you don't have lobster souffle
for five or six,
but Vic is a caterer.
That is a straw man argument right there. I don't buy that.
I just wish that Debbie would have rolled with it a little bit better instead of, I don't know, kind of falling apart. I just didn't like that. I thought that Debbie should always be the strong one in this show, not the one that gets flustered, gets upset. She's allowed to get angry and kind of upset for a minute, but she's always the one that just kind of comes around. Even when she was on TV yelling out that Stockwell is a fucking homophobe, she kind of like calmed down. Then she went to the bar and had a few shots and she was back to normal.
This gave us another side of her. It gave us a gentler side of Debbie that I really liked.
True. There's a nice cute scene when Emmett showed up at Debbie's house. Something I thought was weird about this is she pulls out the whipped cream from under the blanket, sprays it on the ice cream, and then stuffs it right back under the blanket, which anybody that has a whipped cream dispenser knows that there's always a little bit left in the stem. So you put that under the blanket, you're going to get whipped cream everywhere.
Eh.
Yeah.
I thought it was a nice bit of comedy. I'll take it. And I found it really endearing that Emmett and Debbie found a moment of like, we just went through some massive changes in our lives and they sort of went cold turkey with it, but they found a camaraderie in that. And this will allow them to ease back into what it means to be on their own again. They have some support. There's some support there. I just found the scene really cute.
I would have thought though that with Emmett having all the chaos of Ted and then having all the problems with living in the attic with the Dykes, that he would have welcomed a space of his own a little bit more, but he was immediately like, oh, I want to go home with my roommate and watch Friends, was it?
Yeah, that's what the trick said. Big bowl of popcorn, watch Friends, which then I would have been like, get out.
Is Friends that bad? I've never watched it.
Friends is horrendous. I could go into a whole episode of talking about how awful Friends is.
I've never seen it. Who's on Friends?
I'm a little shocked you have to ask this. Okay.
I've never seen it.
So Friends is Courtney Cox, Jennifer Aniston, Matt LeBlanc, Matthew Perry, David Schwimmer, Lisa Kudrow.
Okay. Matt LeBlanc, I think he's on Top Gear now in the UK. It's terrible. David Schwimmer was in a movie with Brad Renfro that Bryan Singer directed called Apt Pupil.
Okay. He's done a lot of stuff since then. he's also one of the co-founders of Looking Glass Theater in Chicago.
No kidding.
Yeah. David Schwimmer plays Ross in the show Friends. And Ross is one of the most reprehensible characters ever written for television. I have massive problems with Friends.
Wow.
Yeah.
Okay, we're going to talk about that off the air. We had one last runner in the show. Ben wrote a book that Michael hates.
So, what's the big occasion? Your golden anniversary?
I just finished my book. And the most important critic gave it a rave review.
I thought you said it was a snooze.
What?
This seemed like some filler content to me. In the last several episodes, I've talked about how Ben is getting these goofy filler stories.
Oh my God.
Let alone any good ones.
Well, you have touched on some of like those filler lines in like I think every episode since we started season 4. This episode really took the cake when it came to
Well, So in episodic television, runners are designed to start setting up future stories or conflicts. And the story does that, but we don't see the payoff for 3 more episodes. The story goes cold. And then we just don't see anything new with it. So it kind of stuck out like a sore thumb in this episode. And you wouldn't know this because you haven't watched ahead since you were 15.
When the series, yeah.
Right. So this one, I think, was another one of those runners that should have really been pushed out. And the pacing of the season could have been done better. So when they broke down the season and set the beats for each episode, it's almost like somebody came in on April 1st and rearranged a few of them, because a lot of the stories don't track very well. And there's not a lot of connectivity between them until you go like 3 weeks later. And then you have to remember back to some of these things.
Like, let's talk about the first moment that we see Ben and Michael at the diner. And Michael is showing like the new pages of Rage, which are like extremely violent.
Suck your own dick, motherfucker. This is definitely some pretty strong stuff.
And that's how Justin wanted it. He insisted it had to be that way.
Michael kind of rolled over on that storyline in their comic being okay, which in the past he has pushed back on. But here he's like, well, Justin insisted on it. Well, okay. Oh, since when did Michael, the author of the narrative, really kind of kowtow to the artistic drawing?
Michael has lost any semblance of a spine that he has built up in the past few seasons. It's just gone this episode.
Well, there's something interesting about the way that Michael is suddenly speaking like a literary critic.
I guess sometimes I didn't know where the story was going. And I wasn't quite sure what the main character wanted, or how it was all supposed to add up.
This isn't the time or place to talk about it.
You're the one who brought it up.
In fact, I never should have asked you to read it in the first place.
Why do you say that?
Let's face it, you don't exactly have a literary background.
Excuse me if I didn't go to Harvard or Yale.
Not your fault that you're more Justice League than Ivy League.
It's this on again, off again intelligence of Michael that we see. Like sometimes he's a total idiot and sometimes he's very profound. His character is just not consistent across the season or even across the entire series. So not surprisingly, Ben's publisher said exactly the same thing that Michael did in his critique.
Well, of course they did.
Yes, but when has Michael ever been that aplomb at reading a book and being able to offer criticism that a professional publishing house would offer the exact same thing?
Like that whole scene where he's trying to figure out the best way to tell Ben what he really thinks about the book. And I just cackled that when he pulled out the actual book, like the manuscript, it reminded me of the QED reports from Don't Tell Mom the Babysitter's Dead. I'm like, what is that? I was like, first of all, I think anyone who wrote what looked to be like 100,000 pages, I would find that a little lengthy.
So if you haven't seen the entire series or really studied it the way that we're doing it, you would have no earthly idea why this story was there, which is why I was calling it filler. The reveal of Michael's book review on the dance floor of Babylon, I thought was good. It had that gladiator-like dance number going on.
Yeah, I don't know what was going on at Babylon that night.
I did like those fight cuts, though, that were woven into Michael's book review.
Yes, but why were the Greco-Roman dancer fighters wearing, like, tighty-whities with their skirts?
I loved it, though. It was great.
I would love something more attractive
like
than that.
Like a jockstrap or something.
Yeah, something like that.
But I thought it was nice camera work, nice direction. That was one high point in the writing, I thought, because it added a visual dimension to what could otherwise just be a boring book critique.
I would have found it so much more interesting if Michael had been honest at this from the go.
Oh, yeah, if he didn't do that first lie to
him. Yeah, if he had just been like, I didn't find it interesting, and here are all my problems with it. And then they would have had to deal with the ramifications of that, of like, well, Ben, you asked for his honest opinion. Because then they have that whole moment on the Babylon dance floor where Ben sort of gets dismissive and whiny about it.
Ben was a dick.
Yeah, I'm like, you asked for his honest opinion, now he's giving it, and now you're being a little bitch about it? Really?
As a professor and a professional writer, he should have been a little more understanding of critiques and just roll with it. Instead, he just is like outright insulting his boyfriend, Michael.
Yes, and they have that moment before it's revealed that the publisher believed the same thing. And I think Michael uses The Catcher in the Rye as the example because Hunter's reading it. So like, I found this boring too. And I only went to community college. If I had liked it, I would have gone to Harvard or Yale. I'm like, okay, first of all, let's not knock those who go to community college. Everyone has a different journey through education. Two, it's fine if you don't like Catcher in the Rye. Not everyone has to like the goddamn thing.
Yeah, you do.
Oh, okay, Patrick.
How about in 6 Degrees of Separation when Will Smith gave that stunning 15-minute soliloquy about it? I thought that was tremendous writing. Did you like that? Is that in the play?
I haven't seen the play live.
Ooh.
I had an opportunity. I could have seen it last spring when it was on Broadway with Allison Janney. That actually was somewhat interesting.
Who did Allison Janney play? The
Stalker Channing role, yeah.
No kidding.
Yeah.
How do I miss all these?
I don't know.
We'll have Allison Janney. So, the final runner of the night, Ted makes amends. This was a pretty small part of the episode. It was woven in throughout all the different stories, but I thought it was important enough to mention because it plays a very key role in the next episode. So, this is the very definition of how runners are part of scripts and how they're supposed to work. I just wanted to call out that everybody should pay attention to Ted walking around making amends to everybody except one. Coming soon, next episode.
I'm super glad you mentioned this because I didn't even register about him making amends until, like, I know
that's what was in the envelope.
Well, yeah, like I know he was doing it, but now that you've pointed it out,
who did he miss?
He didn't talk to Emmett.
Mm-hmm. So this is what a runner is. It's a piece of a story, also called C stories, that's designed to keep you coming back for more. So now that you know that Emmett didn't get his amend, we will be watching next week. You and I will, but. I thought that it was unusual for Ben to get his own amends letter from Ted.
Hey, that is so thoughtful and so brave. And of course we forgive you.
Oh, thank you, guys. Well, I've got a few more of those to deliver, so I guess I'll see you guys later.
Great.
Okay.
Bye-bye.
Did Ted really fuck over Ben at some point, or even Michael, for that matter?
Maybe because they are the core group of friends, that his behavior still had an effect on them somehow.
Well, the victim list that I put together was Melanie and Lindsay, because he stole their money, and Gus, because it was technically Gus's money. It was his college fund. And Emmett. Nobody else was directly impacted by Ted's crystal meth binge. So he's making amends for...
But what? Well, but his behavior still put shock and worry and put his friends through an emotional ringer, even if there was no like physical evidence of his behavior.
I never really saw Ben being all that emotionally wrung by
Ben and Michael are now a package. Like you kind of have to deal
with
that.
Well, even Michael wasn't too much overworked by the meth.
But like the example being like when Ted gets out of rehab and the way he reacted when Michael tried to hold a friendship again together, like together again.
But I think that's step eight. You're supposed to be making amends while you were using, not while you're recovering.
I'm not as familiar with the 12-step program.
Well, I looked it up, and that's how I knew that it was step eight. Because I was really curious about how the writing is going to progress Ted through the 12-step program that he's going through. So you had like the sharing.
Yes.
Mm-hmm. That's one of them. And then you make the amends in step eight. So you're kind of like just over halfway through your journey into this. I just wish that we would have seen a little bit more of Ted coming through this program, because it was such a big deal to see him make the downfall. I would have liked to have seen more of him climbing back up.
Oh, I agree.
And going through a little more shit than just a couple episodes, because now he's employed. He left the job as a singing waiter. He's Brian's right-hand man. He's back into his accounting clothes.
He's sort of back at square one. Great. Thank you.
Yeah. There's some good Ted storylines coming up, though, that you're really going to like.
Exactly. Like, that's something that, because when you have an asset like Scott Lowell playing this part, there's so much more they could have explored, especially if showing him trying to go through all the steps individually.
So let's wrap this episode up. Hits and misses. What was your hit?
My hit was Debbie and Emmett finding comfort with each other. I thought it was cute.
Okay.
I just enjoyed that final moment, them eating ice cream and cuddling up together. It was just really nice.
So that's close to my hit. Mine was Emmett moving out. I thought that was a kind of a nice little fun little distraction. I wish that Mr. Postoff would have done more with it, though. Like seeing him living on his own a little bit longer.
Yeah, seeing him experience the emptiness of the loft would have been great.
Right, versus just saying, I'm
alone.
Right, to the trick.
Again, telling, not showing.
Emmett living alone basically only lasted one episode, and I think that if Emmett would have started to fall far enough to start to gravitate towards back to Ted, that would have been a really interesting play that Postoff could have taken this story. So what was your miss?
My miss was Michael being a wimp again, especially with this whole book thing.
Sure.
Be upfront, be honest, and see what the consequences are. Knowing that he has a partner who's saying, like, this is your book. I did. First of all, the fact that Michael read it, I think, is a huge step.
Yes.
He could have easily just said, like, oh, I couldn't even get through it. The fact that he read the whole thing should be a huge step.
I wish we would know what this book was about.
Oh, clearly I would not even care. But yeah, I think just showing that Michael was going to be squirmy about it again, it's like, let this guy grow up at some point.
My miss was Ben's entire storyline. It came out of nowhere and didn't make much sense for what we know now. We find out more about this in three episodes, like I talked about a few minutes ago.
Mm-hmm.
But here it just feels like the writing room just grabbed something off the runner idea board and dropped it in. And I actually had a second miss.
Oh.
That was Justin stuffing the gun in Chris Hobbs's mouth. That story felt a little like a modern day YouTube video. Like somebody wants to be a director, so they make a video. It just seemed like,
okay,
why would you, what's the meaning of that? Why do you put the gun like in his mouth and make him suck it?
Yes. And the fact that Cody was like, oh, fuck yeah.
Yeah.
I was like, is he getting off on this? Like, what is going on?
Like I've talked about many times in this show, this story is just not plausible. And it's made worse by all of Justin's murderous behavior that's just dropped in future episodes. It's as if this never happened. It's as if he never was running around Liberty Avenue with a gun and pointed in people's mouths, beating up people.
And then just walks away from the whole thing.
Yeah, it's just over. So this has been episode 5 of season 4, How Far You Can Go. Next time on Still Queer as Folk, Debbie and Vic have words over his new life, which ends in tragedy.
Michael and Justin receive good news about Rage, and Brian is told some devastating news.
Do you know what that devastating news is?
I have an inkling.
What do you think it is? One word.
Ball.
That will be episode 6 of season 4, and it's called Death in the Family. That's a Bruce McDonald episode, by the way. Ooh. So I'm really looking forward to seeing that one.
We are on Twitter and Instagram at StillQueerAF and on Facebook at StillQueerAsFolk, where you can continue the discussion. We could also use some fresh reviews and ratings, so please take a moment to help us and rate us on Apple iTunes.
You can find me on Instagram at Patrick Randall if you'd like to connect with me personally, and I really hope that you do.
And you can follow me on Twitter and Instagram at MatthewPD.
Thanks for listening. Until next time, I'm Patrick Randall.
And I'm Matt Dominguez.
Still Queer as Folk was produced by me, Patrick Randall, for Slightly Unbalanced. Matt Dominguez wrote and performed the show with me. Still Queer as Folk is made with love in Chicago.